Welcome to a Wednesday, the 14th of June. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in to KUOW and join us on Twitter at KUOW. In the news today, the gunman who shot a top GOP congressman and several other people at a suburban D.C. baseball practice was a Bernie Sanders supporter with a long history of lashing out at Republicans. You'll hear Bernie Sanders' reaction in a couple of minutes. Also, a UW professor will tell you why the 18-minute gap in the Watergate tapes is a document that changed the world. And we'll talk climate change. Atmospheric scientist Cliff Mass wants us to cool down the conversation. City Council member Mike O'Brien wants Seattle to stay the course on the Paris Climate Accord. You'll hear from both of those guests in just a few minutes. But first, our top story locally. The Kent man who filed a civil suit against Seattle Mayor Ed Murray is dropping his lawsuit. Delvon Heckard claimed Murray sexually abused him in the mid-80s when Heckard was a teenager, and that claim led to the mayor dropping out of his race for re-election. From KUOW's newsroom, Derek Wong joins us. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Bill.
Why is Delvon Heckard dropping his lawsuit?
Well, first, we need to give a hat tip to the Seattle Times, who broke this particular part of the story today. But according to court records, Heckard wants to drop the suit because he wants to complete his drug counseling and recovery work. But he also believes that he has a better chance of winning the case if Murray is no longer in office. We had a reporter at his attorney's offices today, and they believe that while Murray's in office, he has the advantage to, quote, spread lies because he's got the bully pulpit, so to speak. He's tainted the jury pool, they believe. So that's why they want to refile later when Murray's no longer in office.
Okay, so dropping the lawsuit only temporarily and then maybe refiling later. Ed Murray has strongly denied this claim and the other similar claims and said these are politically motivated. How is Seattle's mayor reacting to today's news?
Right now, he's not talking to the media. We had a reporter meeting with him earlier this morning when the story broke that he immediately gathered with his attorneys. We're expecting some kind of statement from him sometime today. But right now, mum's the word from the mayor's office.
Okay, now this is speculative, but Mayor Murray dropped out of his reelection race last month. Could he run as a write-in, change his mind, and be a write-in candidate for his own job?
Right. That's a really interesting question. We checked with the county elections office. They say he would be eligible to run in what's called an undeclared write-in candidate. The rules say that in order for votes to count, the spelling has to be completely accurate. So one interesting question is if people wrote in Edward Murray or if people wrote in Ed Murray, would both count? Mm. A spokesperson at the elections office says they think it would, but they also weren't 100% certain, so they need to get back to us on that.
Yeah, well, that would be unprecedented. So they'll have to figure that out. Maybe. We'll see how all of that goes. Again, we're awaiting a reaction from Seattle Mayor Ed Murray. And our reporters are on the story right now. I'll let you get at it, Derek. We'll have more as it develops. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
Coming up on KUOW Seattle, we are going to cover the news of the day and talk tone of the climate change discussion. Who is overheating the situation? Stay tuned. Today, U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders condemned the attack on a team of Republican congressmen and staffers as they practiced for an upcoming charity baseball game.
Real change can only come about through nonviolent action, and anything else runs counter to our most deeply held American values.
The shooter, who was killed by Capitol Police, had been a volunteer for Sanders' presidential campaign and a vocal critic of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. NPR reporter Susan Davis is covering the story, and she tweeted, "I can't overstate how shaken and emotional lawmakers are today. Everyone I've interviewed has broken into tears discussing the shooting." You've been discussing this shooting as well. On Twitter, Denim on Denim tweeted at us, "We live in a heavily armed country, partly built on subjugation and violence. Until we face our history and ludicrous laws, this will continue." Ian writes on our Facebook page, "Scalise reaped what he sowed." Ian's talking about Louisiana Congressman and Republican House Whip Steve Scalise, who was shot and injured this morning. Ian continues, "He is a rampant NRA stooge, a big part of the gun violence problem." And Leah writes, "There is too much hate and violence in our country. I despise Trump and the GOP. but taking to violence does absolutely nothing more than highlight the absolute ignorance that violence breeds. I pray that all of those who were wounded will be healed. You will, of course, hear more on this story, the latest developments and reaction coming up later this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Now, that shooting in D.C. has put a temporary halt to the ongoing drama in Washington, D.C., the congressional hearings into Russian involvement in our presidential election. That investigation has spread beyond the Russians to involve an attorney general, a fired FBI chief, White House staffers and campaign workers. All of this reminds Senator John McCain of another Washington scandal.
I think it's reaching the point where it's of Watergate size and scale.
Watergate, the break-in and cover-up that brought down a president, Richard Nixon. A key moment in that scandal came when the Supreme Court forced Nixon to release taped conversations he had held in the White House.
They should call the FBI and Senate officials of Congress, don't go any further into this case, period.
That's Richard Nixon saying, tell the CIA to tell the FBI, don't go any further into this case, period. What was on the tapes was damning. The mystery is what was not on those tapes. Suddenly there was a click and a buzz. That gap in the recording is on my next guest's list of documents that changed the world. From the University of Washington Information School, Associate Professor Joe Janes, welcome.
Thank you.
Joe, why is 18 and a half minutes of nothing an important document?
That's a really good question. It isn't actually nothing. When I first started researching this, I thought it was. I grew up during Watergate. I would watch the hearings when I got home from junior high and high school.
Me too.
And you hear 18 and a half minute gap, and I just always assumed it was either cut out or completely erased, and it's not. It's that series of buzzes. So one of the first things I learned about this is that it's not silence. It's a buzz. But the fact that that was missing was among the many sources of suspicion that led to people wondering yet more, what more is there? What more is there? What more is there? And when that gap was revealed, it just reinforced. So many people poured all of their suspicions and doubts and fears and whatever about Nixon and the Watergate investigation and all the rest of it, poured right into that gap. And it just began to take on a life of its own.
You take on something that I've wondered. 45 years or whatever it is later, we know how to find deleted files on a hard drive. Could we recover that tape, that recording today if we wanted to?
They are still trying. The most recent serious investigation was a few years ago. The physical tape still exists, and the investigation at the time really set the standard for forensic audio investigation still today about magnetic tape. What you heard is a digital recording, a digital version of the recording. The actual physical recording still exists. They tried, I think, in 2009 one more time to use more advanced technique. They know that human speech was there. They know it's actually several buzzes. Apparently the machine that made the over-recording was plugged into different electrical outlets, and every electrical outlet has its own signature. I never knew that. So there's changes in the buzzes as a result of that. They know there was speech there. They know it was erased. They know the machine it was used, but they still are unable to recover what's underneath that.
What do we know about, you said somebody erased it purposely, right? What do we know about how that happened?
Not very much. People of a certain age remember Rosemary Woods, who was Nixon's secretary, and she was transcribing tapes. She was the one who discovered the gap, and she copped to about the first 4 minutes of it, because there's this famous picture of her reaching across her desk with her foot on the pedal of the recorder and reaching for the phone, and she thought maybe she had left the pedal down and that might have over-recorded as she was answering a phone call. She says only 4 minutes. There's 18 and a half minutes, 18 minutes and 31 seconds to be precise. And no, there's there are people who think they know that it was White House lawyers who came in the dark of night one night to erase it, that Alexander Haig thought Nixon might have done it himself because he was so technologically inept that he didn't know what he was doing and playing the tape back. There's lots of theories about it, but there's, other than the 4 minutes that Rosemary Woods thought she might have done and actually admitted to, there's nobody knows, and there apparently is no way to know, at least not yet.
So it could have been aliens.
Could have been aliens. I think it might have been Elvis, you know, that he and Nixon had a thing. Who knows?
Well, whoever erased it left enough on there to bring Nixon down. Obviously, the smoking gun tape, right? Why did Nixon have these conversations recorded to begin with?
Well, that's a very good question. He wasn't the first. FDR had a recording system in the White House. So did Kennedy. So did Johnson. You can imagine, you know, for posterity to be able to record meetings, to be able to get transcripts of conversations, to be able to get the record right. Makes perfect sense. So Nixon wasn't the first. He was quite enthusiastic about it. The Oval Office was mic'd. So was the office in the Executive Office Building. Eventually, so was Camp David. Phone lines were recorded as well. But he kept all these things. There's 3,500 hours of recordings from all of these sources now in the Nixon Presidential Library. And he just did it for whatever purposes.
We're talking with University of Washington Information School Associate Professor Joe Janes, who includes that 18-and-a-half-minute recording gap on his list of documents that changed the world. We've told you about why that is. Now let's fast forward, which is what we do when we're talking about tapes. Let's fast forward to today. And, Professor, what is the Russian investigation? How does it remind you of Watergate?
Oh, my God. It's like deja vu all over again. I was watching the testimony yesterday, Attorney General Sessions' testimony yesterday, and former FBI Director Comey last week. And it was just like I was in high school again, and all the networks carried it, and it was the only thing on TV, and apparently Comey got great ratings, I read.
Mm-hmm.
So I never thought we'd be in this situation again. So far as we know, there are no recordings. Lots of people have said there aren't. The president seemed to allude to that in a tweet, which is a document of its own interest.
And then Comey said, Lordy, he hopes
so. Lordy, he hopes so, right, in that kind of folksy way he had of ingratiating himself to the American public, which seems to have worked. It's all very peculiar that we're kind of, you know, revisiting the same territory of what did the president know and when did he know it? And that was the question during Watergate. And that appears to be among the many questions that are still in play today. I did sit through the attorney general's testimony yesterday, and among other things, just to keep myself occupied, I started making a list of all the documents and documentary forms. It's a sickness of all the.
this is your passion. You're in the information school.
True.
You document documents.
If you study documents, this is what you do.
Yeah.
And they talked about letters and emails and calendars and regulations and memos and notes and all different kinds of things. And then they kept asking at the end, well, where are these rules that you say to the attorney general? These rules, where are these rules that say you can't testify about your conversations? And a real focus on where are they written down? Can you show them to me?
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, that means if they're written down, they must be real. And, you know, that's sort of the way we think about documents and documenting things.
Well, then final question, Joe. You have this podcast and a book about historical documents that change things. So what documents are you looking for today that could change the world again?
Well, I end the book with the next one. What's the next one? And, you know, it's entirely possible that the next document that makes a profound effect on human society is not created by a human.
Wow.
It could be created by a computer program, by an algorithm, by some sort of recording device that just goes on about its business and there's no human intervention in that. It could be somebody's grocery list they make this afternoon that has some pivotal role in history. You just never know. It'll be created for some reason. It'll be doing some work. It's going to have some power because we give it that power. And then, you know, weeks, months, years, decades, centuries later, we'll look back on it and think, wow, that was really important, but nobody knew it right then.
Joe Janes from the University of Washington Information School. The podcast is Documents That Changed the World. Your book is Documents That Changed the Way We Live. Professor Janes, a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
KUOW's The Record, coming right back at you in a moment. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. 6 years ago, Seattle poet Tara Hardy was blindsided by a mysterious chronic illness that almost killed her. Hardy told KUOW's Elizabeth Austin what it was like to live with that mystery and what changed once the disease had a name. Here is Tara Hardy reading her poem, Diagnosis.
This poem begins with an epigraph. Death is my wedding with eternity. Rumi. Diagnosis. And the diagnosis comes down. Like a light snow or a palette of newspapers, read all about it. The diagnosis comes down. It has a name. The name is backlash. The name is antichrist. The name is you've just run out of rollover minutes. The name is welcome to the method of your death. We just don't know when yet. The diagnosis comes down. It sounds like rain in February in Seattle. Repetitive. It has a name. Its name is redundant. Just because it has a name doesn't mean it was making me any less sick before I knew its butchering name. It has a name. The name is Butcher. If Butcher meant genocide, I should not use that word. But still, its real name is not enough for all the things it is extincting in me. The diagnosis comes down in partial crowns to be worn sideways like royalty who are asleep or drunk or passively malevolent. It has a name. Its name is Someday You Too Will Wear This Crown of Human Frailty. Then everyone will look at you like you're the sad homecoming queen at the reunion, twice divorced or widowed by things that have names, cancer, car accident, heart attack. If you want to recognize something, call it by its name. Call it and it will come, roll over, bark. The diagnosis comes down. I want to feel relief, but I feel my anticipated relief, dragged into the bushes and beaten. The diagnosis is stuck in my teeth. The diagnosis is stuck in my throat. The diagnosis is written in my chart in someone else's handwriting, next to my weight, which I always tell them I don't want to know, because once I had another diagnosis, culturally prescribed vanity anorexia, and it almost killed me. Sometimes I wonder at what a privilege it was to have vanity before this thing with a name had me turn over my good veins to the nurses on the oncology ward. I remember the lady who put her wig on the handle of her wheelchair. She said, Larry, I'm putting my wig right here. Don't let me forget it. Her diagnosis came down. It had a fistful of hair in its mouth. The diagnosis comes down, and I think, how did I get someone else's diagnosis? No, that's not how you pronounce my name. My name is Grace. My name is Verb. My name is Lilacs in early June, deep purple, early thaw, something to hang your hope on. My name is not sad sack of ballooning skin. My name is not new blue circles under my eyes. My name is not here. Crap in this hat, then bring a spoonful to the hospital. My name is not this could kill you at any minute. Have you tied up your affairs lately? My name is not IV immunoglobulin and $40,000 worth of charity chemotherapy. My name is Tara. It is not disease. And just because I have it doesn't mean you get to define me by it or distance yourself from it, meaning me. The diagnosis came down. Verdict, conclusion, incurable, but nonetheless now something that lives inside me. Let us take her out to dinner. Let us welcome her to the family. Let us rip lettuce with our hands and serve it next to the bread we'll obviously be breaking with our new guest. Welcome, disease. Welcome home to my body that I had previously shared with only a handful of lovers. Welcome to this roof over our heads. You're here for as long as I am. An arranged marriage, so let's make the best of it. Cheers. You've come down. This is my side of the bed, but you're welcome to make me rethink what might be closer to the bathroom. There you are again. I have to pee. There you are again. I have to wheeze. I have to crawl out of this bed of pillows to relieve one pain before I slide back into another. Why did you bring your set of aches? What are you planning to paint on the walls? Do I get to keep my feet? Do I get to keep my heart? Let me keep my heart. This, I ask, disease. If we are going to share a home, then let me keep this four-chapeled room with which I will navigate the world for both of us. There will be a before and an after, a BC and AD of disease. Her name will be as holy as your own. It has to be. Otherwise, there is not enough room in this house. Dear diagnosis, I swear, when I learned your name, I heard wedding bells.
Tara Hardy reading Diagnosis from her collection, My. So Tara, where does this poem come in your process of understanding the scale of your chronic illness?
Wow, that's a great question. I got very sick in 2011 and came very close to death five times, was in the hospital. They really couldn't tell me what was happening with me. And I could not get a diagnosis from anyone inside the Western medicine system. So I went from doctor to doctor to doctor, was getting sicker and sicker. My hair was falling out. My platelets were disappearing. At some point, I had a platelet count of zero.
Wow.
I was at risk for a brain bleed, basically. And I remember the day that one of the doctors came into my hospital room and she gave me the speech to prepare myself. And I went outside and I thought, I cannot get help from the experts, from the people who are supposed to help me. So I wheeled my, what do you call it, that thing?
The IV pole?
Yes, the IV pole down the hall, down the elevator. I wasn't supposed to go outside, but I went outside at Harborview Hospital, that beautiful park. Parks outside of hospitals are mercy. And I sat in that park and I talked to... There was a crow on a light post, and I talked to a bee that kept buzzing around me, and I talked to the flowers that were in bloom all around me, and I asked the universe to help me stay alive if that's what was meant to happen. And the next day, my platelets doubled, and they were able to send me home. I'd been in the hospital, and nothing they had tried helped me. Shortly after that, I was desperate and terrified enough to go see a doctor who was outside the system, and... He's an MD, but he works outside the system, and he specializes in hard-to-diagnose diseases, including Lyme disease. And eventually, his work with me led us to believe that I might have Lyme, and I do. And so he did the test, and that was the day of hope, really, when he was able to diagnose me. But I wrote this poem. I also grieved. The day that I got the diagnosis, I celebrated and rejoiced, but I also grieved because I knew friends who had Lyme and the prognosis is not great. And so I wrote this poem the day after I got the diagnosis. Yeah.
And what did writing the poem offer you? Was there a discovery for you in the writing of the poem?
Yeah. It offered me an opportunity to, one, answer the people who had been asking me the question, what do you have? What do you have?
Right.
What do you have?
Right.
As if it were their business, right? As if just being deathly ill wasn't enough, right? And I think we ask people, I don't think it's malicious, but I think we ask people those questions, what do you have? Sometimes as a means to distance ourselves from, I want to make sure that I'm alive, you know, or I want to make sure that I'm not at risk for that. So it was an answer to that, but it was also a welcoming, because that was the day that it broke open for me that I knew I had to welcome this literal creature that will live in my body for the rest of my life. And if I were to be at war with that creature, it would be a different experience. I just knew that I had to have some kind of perhaps even symbiotic relationship with the disease that lives in me.
Right.
I don't know if that makes any sense,
it helps me understand that very wonderfully strange opening metaphor, the quote from Rumi about death being a kind of marriage and the way you close the poem. I also couldn't help thinking all the way through hearing you read this poem about how much writing poetry is about naming.
Yeah, totally. And I don't name the disease in the poem.
I know. I thought, so my question for you about that is that an intentional choice to allow me as the listener to hear my own possibilities?
Yes, absolutely. And to find yourself in it, and for other people who are ill to find themselves in it too, and to also not answer that question, what do you have, what do you have, what do you have? To really, because we are all susceptible. We are all vulnerable as bodies, you know? And so what do I have? The answer really is human frailty. The answer really is vulnerability. That's what I have.
And the diagnosis is mortality.
Yes. Yes. And we all have it, whether we're in touch with it or not. And I think in Western culture that we aren't as in touch with it as I think some other cultures are. And I think it's actually a disservice that we do to people. Because one of the other things that's happened for me is that spending an entire year of my life believing that I could and would likely die at any moment has opened my life in a brand new way. I don't miss a sunset. If I'm driving home from work and I see the sun setting, I go watch the sparkle on the water, you know? I don't pass up the mangoes at the grocery store anymore, you know?
Yeah, so it's opened my life a lot.
What a great conversation between Seattle poet Tara Hardy and KUOW's Elizabeth Austin. Earlier, you may have heard Tara read that poem, Diagnosis, from her collection, My, 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 My. It's published by Right Bloody Press. Well, you can hear that poem again and read about Tara Hardy at our website, KUOW.org. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bill Radke at KUOW Seattle in Washington State, gateway to Canada. More than ever, people are crossing the border from northern states like Washington into Canada, and they're doing it illegally because that could be your best shot at making Canada your home. Here to explain that is Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, Vaughn. Why would an illegal crossing into Canada be a good idea?
Because if they make it into Canada, they probably get to stay. They apply for refugee status, and we generally tend to let them in if they've got a good case. Word is getting out. You know, I love our relationship with Washington State. I love the preferred route for doing this. So 80% of the people who do this simply walk under the Peace Arch in the park at Blaine. Mm-hmm. And remember the motto on the Peace Arch, may these gates never be closed. Well, they aren't. And people just wander across. Well, we're getting, Canadian authorities say hundreds of people every year. The numbers are up across Canada, right across the undefended border all the way to Maine and New Brunswick. They say it's up this year. There were hundreds last year. There are many more hundreds this year. But we're letting it happen. I mean, there is not a serious effort in Canada to stop this.
Why is that?
The government talked originally when this thing started last year. They talked about doing something about it. And there was initially some alarm that they were going to review refugee policy. They were going to terminate, essentially, an agreement they have with the United States that makes this a little easier, and review refugee policy and revisit all that. And they've basically put all that on hold for two reasons, both political. One is that generally there's enough sympathy in Canada that people are doing this because of the Trump administration and some of his policies. So there's a feeling that Canada should actually let people, you know, flee to Canada and apply for refugee status that they might not get in the United States. And the other thing is, the opposition party here in Canada, the Conservative Party, the Right of Center Party, had a leadership race this year. And a lot of the candidates in there to be, within the realm of political comment, kind of rednecked it up on this issue. And I think the government at that point said, well, if they're going to do that, we're not going there. Let's just let this lie low for a while, avoid stirring things up, and wait and see where the opposition parties come down on this, and so far they haven't. So the Canadian government says the numbers are up, but not alarmingly so. We're not talking about the kind of problem they have in Europe with the boats coming across the Mediterranean and so forth. The numbers are in the hundreds. The increase, that is, in the hundreds, not in the thousands. And the Canadian government says it can manage it at the moment.
Finally, on border crossings, Vaughn, if Canada is so welcoming, will you remind us why people don't apply instead of sneak in?
The way it works is that you apply. The rule is, if you apply for refugee status in the country you arrive in. So the deal between Canada and the United States is that if you're in the United States, you apply for refugee status in the United States. You don't come to Canada. So you have to sneak into Canada because technically you should be applying from the United States. So what you've got is people that are illegally entering Canada, then applying for refugee status. That actually is against the agreement, but generally the Canadian government is saying, well, you know, we're in kind of a messy situation here with the United States at the moment, so we're not going to change it.
Okay, another messy topic, especially several months ago, Vaughn, we talked about this, Vancouver's new tax on foreigners buying real estate there. Some people have talked about doing the same in Seattle, where prices keep rising. So I want to let listeners know how that's going. First, just briefly remind us how that foreign buyer tax came about.
They slapped it on in the middle of a crisis and a political controversy over large numbers of buyers, mostly from China, foreign buyers buying property in British Columbia, leaving it vacant, buying it for speculative purposes. They did a survey, found the numbers were alarmingly high, and they brought in a 15% tax tied to country of origin. Most of the people who it caught were from China. That produced an immediate shock in the system because they brought it in very short order last summer. They collected a lot of money from it initially, and then sales dropped off. The buyers went elsewhere. They went to Eastern Canada where the tax doesn't apply. They went to other parts of British Columbia where the tax didn't apply, and I guess they probably went south of the border to Seattle where there was no tax. But what's happened is the demand for housing in British Columbia is still high, and the Real Estate Association of BC is now reporting that sales are down from where they were at the peak last year, but housing prices are climbing again. The median price is up to $750,000 for house sales. So it slowed things down. It drove some foreign buyers out of the market and sent them elsewhere, and it probably reined in some speculation. But the fundamental problem of demand vastly exceeding supply of single-family homes in Metro Vancouver, that problem remains.
Certainly something we're discussing right here on across your southern border as well, Vaughn Palmer from the Vancouver Sun. Good to talk with you again. Thanks for catching us up on the news from your home.
May these gates never close. Bye-bye, Bill.
Indeed. Thank you, Vaughn. It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Is the environmental left crying wolf on climate change? That's just ahead. KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. What if I told you that the lefty political movement against climate change is broken? That activists have become more like zealots, closed off to skepticism, and they've accomplished nothing. That is the view of University of Washington Atmospheric Sciences Professor Cliff Mass. Mass knows that climate change is real, and he's worried. But he also thinks environmental activists and media are raising a lot of false flags.
They're hyping and exaggerating current weather events. For instance, it was claimed that the cold waves in the eastern United States a few years ago was due to global warming. That's an example. There are other examples claiming that the oysters are dying here in Washington State because of CO2 in the atmosphere. I could list a dozen of these.
The Seattle Times ran a story about a beloved pine tree dying because of essentially climate change.
That's right. That's another one. That one pine tree died because of climate change, and it was really unsupportable. There were things in that article that were patently not true. So I have been calling people on some of these excessive claims.
What is the worst thing about excessive claims? What about, yeah, it's the atmosphere. It's huge and complex, and we don't know everything. But, hey, this is our only planet so far. Let's be better safe than sorry.
Well, I think the first thing is scientists have to tell the truth. Society needs to have the truth. If you're going to plan for global warming, and there's a certain amount of global warming that's going to happen, you have to know the accurate numbers. How much will we warm? How much will the snowpack change? If we're going to change our reservoirs or work on our rivers or do whatever we need to do, society can't work on exaggerated claims or things that are just unphysical. They
but
have
we, can't,
to have...
we can't specifically predict those things that you're saying, right? We don't know how much to the inch this and that's going to happen. That's why I ask about the better safe than sorry.
Well, what we can do is provide information about uncertainty. So there are some things that we're certain about. There's some things we're not certain about. For instance, we are quite certain that increasing CO2 will cause the Arctic ice sheets to melt. And that's the first sign. And in fact, we're seeing that already. But what we're less sure about is whether some precipitation extreme in one part of the country is due to global warming. So there are some things we're very, very sure about. But there are other things that we believe there's a lot of uncertainty. And I think it's very important to communicate that uncertainty to the population and to decision makers.
Why is it so important to communicate the uncertainty? I want to focus on the certainty, which, as you said, you're no denier. We're the Arctic ice is melting and we have trouble. Why not focus on that?
Well, the uncertainty is a very important thing that I'm trying to figure out, and a lot of scientists like myself are. Some of our early climate simulations have been very simplistic. We would do this one or two simulations in the future and say, that's reality. But that's not a very good approach. We need to do many runs. We have to try to get an idea of the probabilities of various outcomes, not to say, you know, this is the worst case or whatever.
Do I have it right that you argue that global warming might be a short-term benefit to poor people?
That's right. I actually did an analysis of this. Some people are claiming that in Washington State, that poor people are preferentially hurt by global warming. And I did a blog about this, analyzing the situation, and found that it was basically just the opposite, that there's really no evidence that poor people will preferentially suffer from global warming in our state.
And why is that?
Well, I'll give you an example. The number one killer of people in our state that is weather-related is black ice on the roadways. That's by far, nothing is killing and injuring our people more weather-wise. Well, it turns out that poor people preferentially suffer from these black ice accidents. They have cars that don't have as good of tires, or they don't have anti-lock brakes, or they drive a lot more mileage early in the morning. And so if you have global warming, you'll have less ice and snow. I can go through other examples. For instance, air pollution. That's a big issue with wood-burning smoke, terribly toxic. Well, there's a lot of poor people who live in valleys and rural areas. Well, if the temperature warms, you won't need to burn as much wood to get your heat, and so there'll be less toxics in the air. That's better for poor people. So I can go over, you know, one thing after the other, and there's really no evidence that poorer people will suffer preferentially from global warming here in Washington State. Now, that may be not true some other places.
Yeah. This is what I want to talk about. Right. It's a matter of emphasis. So I take you to be correct about the effects on driving on black ice. But when we're talking about poor people who are vulnerable to more floods and droughts and storms and habitat change, isn't that the bigger picture that's more worth focusing on?
Well, we have to focus what we're talking about. That blog was put in the context of I-732, the carbon tax initiative for Washington State. And this was an issue about whether we will tax ourselves in Washington State and then return the money in a revenue-neutral way. There were people who were fighting Initiative 732, the carbon tax, saying that's it's wrong because we have to get more money to poor people in our state because they would preferentially suffer.
Now we're getting into the politics of that carbon tax proposal. But speaking of politics, who do you think is more constructive and open-minded about climate change right now, Seattle area and Washington State, Democrats or Republicans in our state?
Well, that's really, it's really hard to say. On one hand, we have the environmental left who are concerned about climate change, but they're really not willing to do anything about it in a substantive way. They have integrated climate change with other things, like they call it climate justice and dealing with labor issues and dealing with poverty. So they have entrained climate change into a whole list of their interests and targets, okay? And that has made it toxic for the Republicans to join them in working on this issue. On the other hand, if you do talk to moderate Republicans, and I have done that, a lot of them understand climate change is a serious issue. And so I think there is hope that we can create a middle group that are willing to take practical steps to deal with climate change.
We're talking with University of Washington Atmospheric Science Professor Cliff Mass. And Cliff, you're not doing your research privately. You're also going on the air like right now, and you're blogging. And when you emphasize what we don't know, which is a lot about climate change, could it be that you have the effect of demotivating people? Because, hey, if a scientist is saying we don't know how bad this is, I don't have to worry about it. That could be a conscious or even unconscious reaction to what you're saying. Do you worry about that?
You know, I think it's just the opposite, strangely enough. There's a lot of people that sense that there's a lot of hype and exaggeration going on. When they hear someone that is talking in a more moderated, fact-based way, they tend to listen more. This is particularly true of people in the middle, including people on the Republican and more conservative side of the spectrum. The fact I've been talking very honestly about what we do and don't know has allowed me to get places that people on the environmental left have not been able to.
Meanwhile, how are you being received among Seattle Democrats or socialists or progressives?
Well, you know, some people are very accepting of it, are very positive, but I have to admit there are some people on the environmental left who are very unhappy with me. And I get some pretty nasty comments on my blog and other locations. Recently, I had a debate with someone in The Stranger. A reporter from The Stranger was writing headlines that I lost my mind, I was crazy, that I was dangerous. And that's because I was talking about things like I'm talking about here, the fact there is uncertainties that we have to get a handle on.
Okay, so someone listening to you right now, Cliff, what should they do about climate change? Because you're not saying be inactive. What do you want people to do?
No, in fact, I want people to be much more active than the environmental lefters are pushing them for. Number one thing is we have to first do the research, supporting in places like the University of Washington and other places to understand what's going to happen. So that's very important.
Pay tax dollars for research.
Yeah, research or give contributions, whatever. I think research is absolutely crucial. We have to maintain that to understand what's going to happen. Then people need to do what is critical to make us go forward, and that is to help support new energy technologies and energy conservation technologies. Right now, the United States is only a small part of the problem. Right now, China is producing twice the amount of carbon that it's putting in the atmosphere than we are. India is growing rapidly. Other countries are as well. And so the only way out of this problem is going to be technical. Very few people are willing to sacrifice, financially sacrifice, in any real way. In fact, if you look at there's various questionnaires, what people care about in terms of major issues, climate change is like number 10 down on the list. There was a recent study that found that most people are not willing to spend as much as $10 a month to do something about climate change.
But again, isn't that all the more reason to sound the alarm bell and not emphasize how far off and uncertain the damage will be?
Well, I mean, my research, and I've talked about on the blog, that by the end of the century, it's going to be warmer here. There'll be less snowpack. The precipitation will be heavier. So I'm pushing that kind of stuff. But what I'm not telling people is that every major storm or every tree that's dying in the Arboretum is due to global warming. Now, let me tell you something. There's a real danger to exaggeration. And the snowpack issue is one that proves the point. It wasn't that many years ago that Greg Nichols, our mayor, was talking about snowpack disappearing. There was one bad snowpack year, and he was saying, you know, that's it. It's climate change. Our snowpack's down by 50%. It's not coming back. He did an editorial in the Seattle Times. Well, unfortunately for him, the snowpack did come back. And so we've had some pretty good snowpack years. And in fact, if you look at the trend over the last 30 years, in fact, the snowpack's not going anywhere.
But what if people read that Greg Nichols editorial and said, oh my God, it's my responsibility to get on the bus and get out of my single occupancy car. And in the years since, they've realized, hey, the bus isn't so bad. You know, what if people will act based on fear, even if you think the fear is exaggerated?
Well, this is crying wolf. So then 5 years from now, the snowpack's back and they say, these people lied to me. I did all these actions. And then you would be much less likely to listen to the forecast 20, 30 years from now. Now, we have to tell people the truth. This business about trying to panic people and lie to them, this is not the way to do business. It ruins scientific credibility. Society can't plan on lies. It just is not the way to act. I think society and our politicians and decision makers need to know the best truth that we can give them.
That is Cliff Mass, a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Washington. You may have heard him mention debating a Stranger reporter recently. That was Charles Mudede, and we are tweeting out a link to that debate right now at KUOW. So, Cliff Mass says the environmental left is misrepresenting climate change and not helping the situation. I'd love to hear what our next guest thinks of that argument. Seattle City Council member Mike O'Brien just sponsored a city resolution to uphold the Paris Climate Accord that President Trump pulled out of. Council member O'Brien, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Before we get to your resolution, I want to know, what do you think of that atmospheric science professor saying the overheated environmental left is not helping on climate change?
I have a lot of issues with what I heard Cliff Mass just say, and I'm not quite sure where to begin. I'm assuming I'm the environmental left, and I think, you know, using brands and tags like that are not particularly productive.
Well, he didn't call you out, but you happen to be the next guest, but here you are.
I imagine I would be. I think the questions you asked him are really good. We need to be using the best science we have. The science is very clear that we have significant impacts due to man-made climate change locally and around the planet. And yes, we don't know exactly what that means for next year's ski season or how much snow we're going to have in the mountains. But what the science does show us is that over the next 50 years, we need to plan for, on an average basis, less snow for our generating electricity, less snow generating our water supply. And so we're planning for that, and we're already investing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to accommodate that.
If you're an environmental lefty, have you been guilty of exaggerating what we can honestly say about the effects of climate change?
You know, I try to be very careful to use the best science that I'm aware of when I talk about things. So when we have storms, it's, you know, I'm not a climate expert on this, but my understanding is it's really hard to say that this storm was caused by climate. What I do say is what the scientists are telling us is we will see more of these storms as the planet warms, as climate change happens. And in fact, we are seeing more of them now than we have before. So no, I can't blame this rain event on climate change, mm-hmm. but this is the type of event you would expect to have. And I try to be very clear with the public.
Okay, finally on Cliff Mass, is he out of line by calling attention to how little we know about the dangers and saying climate change could actually help local poor people short term?
I think he's way out of line. And to cherry pick something like the black ice and poor people have worse tires and completely overlook countries like Bangladesh that are going to be ravaged by climate change and somehow allow people to think like, oh, it's not that urgent. Let's not worry about it for now, I think is disingenuous. And I think it's morally bankrupt.
Okay, now let's talk about what the city of Seattle is doing now. When President Trump pulled out, by the way, this is Seattle City Council member Mike O'Brien, when Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement.
The bottom line is that the Paris Accord is very unfair at the highest level to the United States.
You sponsored, and the council has passed, a resolution to live up to the Paris Accord. First step is to pressure Puget Sound Energy to stop using coal. But PSE doesn't serve the city of Seattle, so why is that a top Seattle priority?
Well, PSE does serve the city of Seattle with natural gas, but the electricity that we're talking about, you're right, that is, you know, people in the city of Seattle get their electricity from Seattle City Light. The public-owned utility has been carbon neutral for over 10 years. We would like to see people throughout the region have access to 100% carbon neutral electricity. Puget Sound Energy has the capacity to do that. We've plans to phase out all the coal plants in Washington State, which is a great thing. But what people don't always know is a lot of our electricity is coming from coal plants in the state of Montana, specifically Colstrip, that Puget Sound Energy owns and is importing that dirty electricity. We would love to see them phase that out and move to renewables as soon as possible.
You would love to see that. Does the city have the authority to change what Puget Sound Energy does?
We don't have any regulatory authority over Puget Sound Energy's electricity generation.
So then the question, as you know, you've heard, is this purely symbolic? Is it helpful for the city to say, we're in on Paris?
So, you know, the resolution has a number of points it makes, and absolutely the city needs to figure out how to do their part. We passed a climate action plan a few years ago that commits the city to being carbon neutral by the year 2050, and a 58% reduction in carbon emissions over, I think, 2007 levels by the year 2030. There's a number of steps that we've laid out in our plan to achieve that, but that plan also includes assumptions about what the federal government's going to do. What kind of fuel efficiency do we expect cars to have in the next decade or two decades? Our whole plan is built around a broad set of assumptions. If the federal government is pulling out of Paris and is going to backtrack on some of the fuel standards for automobiles, what that means is locally at the city, we may have to do more in other areas to offset that. So, for instance, if the average automobile is going to be getting 25 miles per gallon instead of 35 miles per gallon, in the city of Seattle, we may need a significant increase in electric vehicle uptake so that we get the net benefit we want. So those are the types of changes that we need to make within our jurisdiction that we do have control over that we need to address, but we can't do it alone.
To get a net benefit regarding climate change, who in the city of Seattle will sacrifice what because of your resolution?
Well, you know, I actually believe that when we talk about living in a carbon-free future or fossil-free future, the sacrifices we're talking about are largely going to come from large fossil fuel companies that are making billions of dollars. You know, people in Seattle want mobility. Right now, what that means for a lot of families is I need to own a car to get from point A to point B. But I don't think people say, I love my car and I love that it spews pollution out and that my kids have asthma and there's climate change. If we delivered cost-effective, very efficient light rail, people will take that. Reliable bus service, people will take that. If we have electric vehicles that cost less, have 250-mile range, and you could recharge them in 10 minutes, clean energy, much cheaper to operate, people would love those. So those are the types of investments we have to make. And I actually believe everyone in the city, from the richest to the poorest, will be better off when we make that set of investments.
Part of what keeps Seattle from meeting carbon emissions targets is growth in traffic. Are you making a promise you can't keep as long as Seattle is booming?
Well, we do need to look at per capita emissions. And so what we do know is that as people move to cities like the city of Seattle, their carbon footprint goes down. I haven't looked at these numbers in the last few years, but historically, if you live in New York City, your carbon emissions are about one third of the average American. And the reason isn't because people that live in cities are greener, although we might be or think we are. We live in smaller households because there's not much room. We have shared walls because we live in apartments, so it's easier, more efficient to heat. Transit systems work in dense areas where they don't work very well in rural areas. So we have access to transit. The grocery store may be 6 blocks away instead of 6 miles away. All those things add up to not like significant sacrifices you make. It's just the reality of when you live in a city, it's a much more energy efficient way to live. And so we want people to move to the city, and we still need to make more investments in alternatives to sitting in a fossil fuel burning vehicle stuck on I-5.
We're talking with Seattle City Council member Mike O'Brien, who's sponsored a resolution, and the council's passed it, that says the city of Seattle will uphold the tenets of the Paris Climate Accord. Council member, I'd like to ask you something else. The Kent man who filed a civil suit against Seattle Mayor Ed Murray is dropping his lawsuit, we've just found out. This is Delvon Heckert, who claimed Ed Murray sexually abused him in the mid-80s when Heckert was a teenager. Of course, that claim led the mayor to drop out of the reelection race. What do you think of the accuser dropping the civil lawsuit and saying he'll refile after Murray's out of office?
You know, I just don't know enough to comment on that, other than to say that, you know, that whole period we've gone through for the last months on all sides has been horrific. You know, victims having to relive their experiences when it's played out in the media like that, I know has been very challenging for folks. And obviously the mayor was in some challenging positions, and I can't comment on the veracity of anything. And, you know, I'm hoping the city is moving on beyond that episode, whatever the reality was.
Ed Murray has said that these claims were politically motivated. Any comment on that?
I've heard those claims, too. And, it's not having any different facts than the public has. It's really difficult to think on both sides of what this meant. And it's just a hard time. And I'm looking forward to moving beyond it all.
We will continue to watch this mayoral election play out. We've been talking with Seattle City Council member Mike O'Brien live here on KUOW, and we appreciate you coming in and talking with us. Thank you for that.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Coming up tomorrow, Seattle wants an income tax on rich people. Rich people? Who's rich? Well, you are if you make over $250,000. Good idea? We're going to debate that tomorrow on KUOW. Thanks for listening today, and BBC News is next.